Okay, it doesn't matter.
We have dead spaces in there.
See if we have enough volume later on here to.
If we want to get up and have a beer.
Yeah. Okay, so here we are. We're at Tom Simpler's home, Kodiak. And my name is Tom Cox. And we're going to. Tom's going to tell us a little bit about his life, where he was born, and so forth. And we're just going to let him talk. I've got some questions here for you. By the way, the date is November the 17th. That's a Thursday night. All's well here in Kodiak. It's a little bit windy today. Mm-hmm. We're sitting here in his living room and got us a couple of cool ones. Kind of getting into the spirit here. So Tom, we can start off by maybe asking you about your parents and a little bit about the parents and work our way through and bring us up to the time you got to Kodiak.
Okay, let's see if I start with my father. His name is Charles Simpler. In fact, both of my parents, they are they're both originally from Delaware. And we're going to kind of hasten through it. I think my dad, he kind of conjured his way into the Merchant Marine at about age 16. He had to lie about his age to get into the Merchant Marine. And let's see, this would have been about the mid-20s when he went into the Merchant Marine. He went in as a cabin boy, and by the time he decided to get out was about the time he decided to get married, and I think he'd worked himself up to chief mate then. He was in a position where he could have taken his, you know, sat for his captain's license, but being that he's wanting to get married, he didn't want that kind of life where he was going to be going to sea all the time.
So how old was he when he got out?
Let's see, that would have been about 1939, and he was born in about 1911. So we're talking about 28 years old, something like that. Is that sound right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, about 28.
And so he married and settled?
And he married a gal from Delaware as well. In fact, they'd gone to the same high school, but their age difference was pretty significant. In fact, I think he's about 7 or 8 years older than her, but and they'd known each other as kids, but I guess on some opportunity when he went back during the time he wasn't at sea, he met her again, and she'd been working in Philadelphia doing office work up there. And I don't know what kind of courtship they had. They never really explained it very much, but anyway, he'd met some guys some longshoremen in Oregon when he was in there with the ship. And they talked him into buying into a small clam cannery in Cordova, Alaska. And he decided to do that because he wanted out of the Merchant Marine. So he went back and got married to her. And sometime in 1940, or maybe it was 1939, they moved to Cordova.
39,
either 39 or 40, I'm not absolutely sure of which. And back in those days, the only way you got up here was by Alaska steamship. There was no airline service or anything like that. You had to ride a steamer from Seattle. And I know my mom has told me many times that dropping her in the, you know, from being in Philadelphia and working in Philadelphia for 6 or 7 years, and dropping her in Cordova, Alaska was really culture shock.
Oh, yeah.
She didn't have any friends, didn't know anybody, just really a small town, not many conveniences.
So she got here by going through Oregon, then coming up?
From Washington, from Seattle. I think they go cross country by train and then took the ship out. And actually, the good friends that they did have were the people that they met on the ship coming up. You know, it was about a 2-week trip or something like that, maybe not that. That sounds a little bit wrong, but they made a lot of friends on the ship coming up. People that were headed to Cordova for the same reasons they were, you know, to
so like find
prosperity, yeah. And those people they met ended up being some of their very best friends for life, yeah, the rest of their life in Cordova. So,
so what kind, you talked about that she had some problems adjusting when she was, it was real hard for her.
Well, yeah, he was gone a lot. He was fishing, and she didn't have a lot of friends, and just was very lonesome, and no way to, you know, she was away from her family, and no way to really contact them. In fact, I think her, if she got up there in 39, her first trip back was about 1944 or something like that. So she was up there about 5 years before she ever saw her family again. But she got used to it, and let's see, I was born in 41. My brother Bob was born in 44. And that's about the time we made our first trip back to Delaware. And then we came back, and let's see, I had a sister that was born in 46. And then my dad was kind of getting fed up with things, and he thought he'd go back to Delaware and see if we could make a living there, a carpenter. So we went back there in 48 and 49, and he tried that, and it just wasn't in the cards. So we came back to Cordova in 49, and then I had a...
Do you remember the trip going back?
Coming back up here?
You would have been...
I don't remember any of those trips.
It's 44, 40, you would have been 8 or 9, right?
Yeah, I don't remember either of the two trips. The one in 44, I don't remember anything about. We went down on steamship then and cross country and train. And then in the 49 trip, we did fly outside.
Oh, you flew?
Yeah, in 49 there was airline by then. And but we went across country on train. And I have vague recollections, but boy, that's it. And then in the meantime, in the year he was trying to make a living there in Delaware, I had my youngest sister was born. Her name's Kathy. But that didn't work, so we moved back to Cordova in 49, and we've been there ever since. You know, up until the time I graduated from high school. And my dad, it was tough to make a living in those days. He was he fished commercially, and that was salmon. Dug clams commercially, fished halibut commercially, and then Cordova was a town with not much opportunity in the wintertime, so he just had to really grub for every job he could get during the winter. You know, anything he could get, he would take. But he usually managed to stay busy enough to feed the family, but we didn't have any excess of cash floating around, I know that.
Okay, back to fishing, what was the name of his boat?
During that period of time, he didn't have his own boat. We never had our own boat till 1960. So he usually fished with other people all that time. Now in the mid 40s, he did buy in with another guy and had a boat for a few years, and it was called the Joe. It was named after the other guy that he was partners with. Yeah. Then that guy started living in the fast lane and doing a lot of drinking, and he wasn't real responsible, and Dad had to get out from underneath that deal, so I think he just sold the boat to the guy and then started out fishing with other people.
So they fished, did they fish halibut, salmon?
Yeah, they fish halibut, salmon, dug clams, fish crab, or fish Dungeness crab over in that area. But there just wasn't any price for the product, and it was, you know, and it there were bum years then too, and it was tough to make a living.
Now, did you ever go out with your dad on a boat?
I started going out with him in I think 1954 was the first year, and that was just salmon fishing, salmon gill.
So you would have been,
I was about fifth 15, grade.
Oh, you only 41 then. 54. Yeah, you would have been.
Probably about 13, 14 years
13
old, something
or so,
like
yeah.
That. And I haven't missed a season. That was drift gill netting on the Copper River, and I haven't missed a season since then. That's well over 40 years now. So I fished with him from 54 up through 60, and then we kind of pooled our resources, and we built our own boat in 1960.
You built it yourself? Had it built?
Well, my dad and I and another guy built it. We had a, he was kind of a master carpenter, and he supervised the job. And we just helped
his
him.
Name?
His name was Martin Anderson. He was a native.
Martin Anderson.
Yeah. Alaska native, and the man was just a fantastic woodworker, just a gifted carpenter, boat builder. And we started that boat, I can remember about, it was all wood boat, and started about the middle of July and launched it in the middle of May.
May of 1960?
That was in 1960, the year I graduated from high school.
Well, that must have been something to launch a boat in the same year that you were graduating.
Oh, yeah.
That felt pretty good.
We're pretty busy. We're pretty proud of it. It was a beautiful boat.
Yeah. But I mean, just culminating into, you know, you're graduating, now you're launching your boat. And you guys went out fishing it, probably that's
yeah, and we fished that kind of as a family operation with my brother and myself and my dad and my mom. We seined that boat from 60, I'm trying to think, up until about, we sold the boat in 81. But my mom, she didn't fish with us for about the last 5 years. But my brother and I and my dad stuck together on that boat till we sold it in 81.
And what was the name of it? Did you tell me the name?
The Vecci. Vecci. It was, my dad made up the name. It was named for Violet, who was my mother.
Oh.
And E, who was, Edward was my brother's middle name.
C for Charles.
And then the C for Charles and Charlotte and Kathy, and then I. I mean, I don't know what the I was, just to fill it out.
Okay, so your name is Charles.
Yeah, Charles Tom.
Charles Tom Simpler. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I don't, did we get a, let's go back a little bit. Did we get your birth date?
I was born in 1941, December 15th, 8 days after Pearl Harbor was bombed. That's an easy way to remember.
Yeah. Okay.
And I was the first in the family, and the oldest.
Let's just go ahead and stop the tape and just kind of make sure that it's recording, because I'd hate to lose this. So you were saying that you were the, as far as the...
Yeah, I'm the oldest of the four children in the family. And I've got a brother, Bob, who, he's 2 years younger than I am, and a sister, Charlotte. And Bob is a retired teacher now. He still fishes commercially. But he's moved down to Whidbey Island in Washington. I have a sister, Charlotte, who is 4 years younger than I am. Her and her family they're still in Cordova. Her husband's a fisherman, and she's a nurse. And I have my youngest sister is named Kathy, and she's a nurse, and she lives in Anchorage with her family still now. And my parents are both still living, and they come up and spend their summers in Cordova, and then they go out to Florida for the winters. Both for as old as they are, they're in really good health. Surprisingly good health.
Yeah. That's great. So you let's go back a little bit. You brought us all the way up to the present, and also brought us up to the time that you graduated. Maybe we can go back and just kind of reminisce a little bit. Maybe when you were a child, when you were even before adolescence. If you remember, you already talked about some trips. Do you remember any trips locally around Cordova, any specific trips that stand out in your mind, if you might have gone somewhere, even on transportation, in by train or by boat? You'd already talked about that you'd gone down back to the Gulf 48 on the plane. Anything stands out in your mind? If it doesn't, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I was real active in Boy Scouts, and we did kind of a lot of unique things there because we had some real good leadership. And I know one of the trips that I really remember I made two trips that are really impressionable. And one is where we went up in the interior in Alaska, just our scout troop and the scout masters, and just spent a week and a half on our own at a lake up in the interior, you know, where we built our own lean-tos. And just, we had nobody else with us other than that. They flew us up there, and we stayed a week and a half, and that was just a great experience. Probably about 20 of us.
Was it outside Fairbanks? Or?
No, it was outside of Glen Allen, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
I think the place was called Willow Lake. I've tried to find the exact location in later years where we camped, and I've never been able to do it. You know, I thought we could find, I've gone back in there and thought I could find signs of the lean-tos, you know, but there wasn't enough memory there to take me back to the place.
Yeah, things always change and look a lot smaller when you go back as well.
I think I was in the approximate location. And then I remember another another scouting trip I went on is where we went up and spent about a week in Eielson Air Force Base. You know, and when you're born and raised in Cordova, those are really eye-opening experiences. You know, being in an Air Force Base where you've never seen anything like that before. And that's also when Fairbanks was really knee-deep in gold mining, and we got to go out and visit the Esther area where the gold mining was still hot and heavy. And by the time I got up to college there, you know, that all was, you know, just almost defunct, gold mining was. So those are two real memorable trips that I can recollect. We never got out of town that much. We never had a lot of money, and I never traveled very much. So the only other real travel opportunities I had is when I played basketball in high school. And then, you know, we'd get to Wasilla and get to Valdez and Glen Ellen, but we never even did a lot of traveling there. So
and you would go by plane more than that.
Yeah.
So when you went on these basketball trips, was it just regular wheel planes and airport to airport?
Well, a lot of time going over to Valdez in the wintertime like that was, you know, we got stuck there for a week at a time. We'd go over to play ball games on a weekend and end up spending a whole week there because we'd be weathered out. And that was real interesting because about after the weekend, about Sunday, you were out of cash and you had to go through the rest of the week trying to scrimp what you could and make do with what
you
could.
That must be kind of tough on your grades and missing out on class and stuff.
Yeah, I don't remember that part of it being such a problem, but we'd shovel snow over there and take any jobs we could get to make a few bucks.
In Valdez.
Yeah. I can remember being stuck there two different times for about a week at a time. Now the kids ride the ferry, you know, so that's more dependable. They can get back and forth easily.
Yeah. It takes a little bit longer, but it's a sure route.
So as far as trips when I was young, that was pretty much it. Not a lot of them.
You remember any particular fishing trips that might stand out, like maybe anybody had some bad weather or a storm or?
Oh,
I know,
sure,
you were here.
Over the 40 some years I've been fishing, I've been in some real jams before. Things that I don't care to go through again as long as I live. I know that.
Emergency situations, you mean?
Well, things were really hairy, where it was nip and tuck, you know, bad weather and bad predicaments. But my dad always said that a cool head will, you know, usually carry you through. You don't want to panic when you get in jams like that. And I'm convinced that he's right. As long as you keep a clear head and don't do stupid things, you probably make it. And one of them is just staying with your boat. You know, trust your boat till the very end. A lot of people will panic and, you know, abandon ship or whatever, and that's a major mistake. Yeah, I can remember lots of incidences, not lots of them, but many an incident that I would never care to repeat again. I've gotten a lot more conservative.
You don't have to repeat it here.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot more conservative in the fishing, but then we have better equipment now. I mean, we have, there's no reason why you should ever get in a jam with the equipment that we have anymore. They're more seaworthy, the boats we have, they're faster. You get better weather forecast predicting, you know. Back and you got better navigational aids, both on the boat and what's available, you know, on the sea. Golly, when I first started fishing, you didn't have any more, you know, you were lucky to have a compass, and if you had a depth finder that worked, that you were lucky, but that was about it.
How about this? So we have just tried to go back a little bit as far as and try to cover your life, and we're eventually going to work up to Kodiak. Now, how about we talk a little bit about high school, about the sports and getting out and so forth. Can you describe what the high school is like that you went to, and anything that stands out in your mind that might?
Oh, I loved growing up in Cordova. I mean, I just thought it was the greatest place in the world. It was small. I graduated with a class of 18, so you can imagine there were less than 100 kids in high school. And, I don't remember a lot about it, but we were a real close-knit group of kids. You know, everybody knew everybody really well. And
typical subjects in any high school?
Yeah, pretty much.
Woodshop.
Even for a small school, yeah, surprisingly, woodshop and pretty good science and math curriculum. And
any boat building?
Not really boat building, but we built a lot of implements for boats. You know, I only took shop 1 year. You know, and we build things like pumps and bailers and clubs and you name it. You know, just different things you might use in the fishing operation. Gear rollers and things like that. But we never did take on a boat. We didn't have a shop that was equipped for it. This wasn't big enough. And one thing I can remember, we used to have an hour-long lunch period, so I always went home at lunch. Most of the kids in Cordova went home for lunch. And because we had an hour-long lunch, and they just cleared the school out, which is interesting, you know, compared to nowadays. I imagine there's just a handful of kids that would go home for lunch. And we had study halls, which we don't have anymore. Definitely remember study halls. But it was a small, close-knit group, and I still see a lot of the people that I graduated when I go back there in the summertime, you know, to graduate with. But when you have a class of 18, and I think three of them are already died, you know, that's down to 15, and one of them, there's about 14 left. And some of them I haven't seen for years, seen or heard of.
Do you go back for, do you have class reunions here?
No, we never had a class reunion. We never sent back to one.
Okay, so now you graduated from high school, you fished for a while and...
Graduated in 1960.
60 and then...
Went up to the University of Alaska in Fairbanks the following fall. And spent 5 years there.
And that's where you got your degree and your teaching?
I got my Bachelor of Science in Math and also my teaching credential. And then 2 years before I graduated, I met my wife-to-be and courted her for a year up there. And then before my last, no, yet courted her 3 years before I graduated. And then the last 2 years we were married, we were up there in marriage student store on campus. And as I remember, I had to go a fifth year or a semester of the fifth year just to get student teaching in. And there weren't any real job opportunities for teaching, so I just got in a postgraduate program and went another semester up there during the fifth year and worked on some postgraduate things and then started applying for different schools around the state. I don't know, I had my heart set on getting someplace in Southeastern. Don't ask me why, I look back on it and I don't know why, but both Arlene and I were looking at Petersburg or Sitka or someplace like that.
Maybe it's proximity to North 48 or something.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. We just heard a lot of good things about them, I guess. And it was one part of Alaska we hadn't spent any time in. But, you know, as we waited out the different job opportunities and the Kodiak job came along, well, Arlene was a Kodiak graduate.
Oh, really?
She graduated from Kodiak High School a couple of years before that.
Now, what's your maiden name?
Her name? Roscoe. Arlene Roscoe, and her dad was in the FAA, so that's why they happened to be in Kodiak. They've been in all kinds of different places. I think she'd been in a place called Tyonic, which is kind of across Cook Inlet from Anchorage. I know she'd been in the village of Unalakleet for a while, and then they came to Cordova for a while, but this is when she was fairly young. I knew who she was when they came to Cordova, but I think she left there when she was about in seventh grade. Then they came over here to Woody Island. I don't know if you're familiar with Woody Island, but it's just off the shore out here. And that's where the FAA station was up until about 15 years ago. And then they moved it out to the base.
That FAA stands for Federal
Aviation Agency.
Agency.
And then her father moved to Anchorage, and that's where he finished his career there in Anchorage and retired from the FAA. Well, anyway, one summer after Arlene graduated, she came back to Cordova, and that's where we kind of hooked up together again. And then she decided to go to Fairbanks. And after a year of courtship, we got married and spent the last 2 years up there as married. And Carrie was born in '63, and so she was up there with us during our last year, the year I graduated, which was the spring of '65. And like I say, we job hunted, I probably had a half a dozen, no, probably more than that, probably a dozen applications in. Applied to Fairbanks, Wasilla, Anchorage, the Kenai, Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka, Petersburg, Wrangell, all of them. Every place I could get an application and I put one in. But like I say, when the we didn't hear, and finally the one came from Kodiak, and he kind of offered me what I wanted, and it was a high school job. And of course, Arlene was real eager to come back. She had a lot of friends here.
Who was the principal in the superintendent?
Well, the superintendent was named Ivor Schott, and he's the one that offered me the job here. And so we packed up things, and in fact, I had an old Chevy pickup and packed that thing just full of everything it would carry, drove it down to the Homer, and...
Down to the Homer?
To the Homer, yeah. And got on the Testamina and made our first trip over here. That would be the fall of 65. And the Testamina was almost a new ship then. I think it had been in service about a year then. And back then it was real short and stubby. No sense in, they've really modified it. They lengthened it out. I think they added 50 foot or something to it. It made all kinds of modifications, but it wasn't the most seaworthy thing in the world. I should say it's seaworthy, but it was not pleasant to ride on back in those days. It was, you know, kind of sat high in the water and it would roll a lot. But anyway, we made the trip over here to Kodiak and have been here ever since then.
So you started, you were teaching math then, right?
Yep, teaching math in Kodiak High and started in the fall of 65. And back then, as I remember, the school was in the general area where the middle school is right now, the high school was.
Okay.
And the whole town was torn up on this urban renewal deal because, you know, the 64 earthquake, that downtown area was really devastated.
So you could still see a lot of that evidence.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
64.
They cleaned 65. Most of the buildings out, but there were just a lot of empty holes around town, you know, where there was no buildings. So the school was still trying to, you know, to accommodate those changes. I think they had a place called Old Main School, and we were still had some of our classes in that, not the high school, but the elementary did, because I mean, if you remember, Betty Springhill was principal down there. But I came here, I think we probably had about 25 teachers in the high school in that year. Close to a dozen of them were brand new.
25?
25.
Oh, that's a pretty small school.
Yeah.
You're talking about 300, 350?
Yeah.
Total student population?
Around that. And like I say, out of those 25, about a dozen of them were brand new teachers. We really had a crop of new people, all about my same age, with about no experience like I had either. So it was an interesting year.
Did they have a turnover?
Oh, major turnover the year before.
So you say the high school was where the junior high is now, the middle school,
uh-huh.
Middle school now. And where was the middle school? Was it somewhere else?
The middle school was all self-contained then. There was no such thing as a middle school. It was just all the K through 8 were self-contained classrooms. So you had sixth grade classes, and an eighth grade teacher taught all the subjects to eighth grade. It wasn't, you know, what we call compartmentalized or like it is now.
Yeah. So they were somewhere else.
They were in the same building, but they were up kind of where the sixth grade area is and the middle yeah. school now in that way.
And now, maybe you could explain a little bit to us about maybe the student population as far as was it Caucasian, those kinds of things, and also as far as the village schools.
You know, well, see, back then, I'm not sure when I first came here if the BIA still had control of some of the village schools or not.
BIA?
The Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Okay.
See, at one time, they'd had, if memory serves me correct, they ran all of the village schools. And it seems like to me when I first came here that some of the village schools were still under the control of BIA. And some of them had made the transition where the local school district had taken responsibility for them. I do know that the base school was what they call a state-operated school.
That's it.
It was operated
Coast
by the state
base.
Of Alaska. Yeah, out at the coast. Well, it was a Navy base then. It wasn't a Coast Guard
base.
So they called it a state-operated school. And those teachers didn't work for our system at all. They worked for the state. And I'm sure there were still a few of the village schools that were part of the BIA, you know, but not all of them. And let's see, what were we kind of jar my memory on what we're trying to talk about here?
Well, I know that when a student would get up to, let's say, the high school level, someone was telling me that they would move into town and they would finish their high school in Cody.
Yeah, well, there were no high schools out in the villages at all.
Okay.
None at all that I remember.
So how did that work?
So, well, a lot of those kids, if they were fairly good students, they used to take them down to Mount Edgecombe out of Sitka. That was just a high school for natives. So a lot of the kids that were, you know, that were reasonably good students, that's where they went to high school, at Mount Edgecombe. And then if they had an overflow from there, I think there was a place in Oregon called Chimawa or something like that. Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard of Chimawa, yeah.
Yeah, and I think any overflow used to go down there.
If I'm not mistaken, that's just right between Portland and Salem off by five.
It might be. Yeah. You know, I just remember the name. And then, of course, there was others. If they could find, you know, have relatives to live within town, I'm sure they'd come in from the villages and go to school in town. But there, it doesn't seem like... But anyway, looking back over the annuals, it just seems like we had a high percentage of Caucasian. And, of course, the Navy-based students were all going to high school here then. Prior to that, prior to my coming here, and I can't remember how many years it was, the Navy base had their own high school out on the base. And it was called that, Kodiak Naval School or something like that. But by the time I got here, and I think several years before, that they closed that down and the Navy kids were all coming into town. And then, of course, we had we had a percentage of local natives attending school here, too. But not a large percentage, it didn't seem like to me. So the ethnic mix of our school system has changed markedly, you know, from that time to the present, considerably. You know, it's been in a process of transition. And let's see, we went until about 1971 or 1972 when this regional high school complex was built up here by the state. They built the current building that we're in right now. And with the exception of the wing that has the gym and the library in it. And then they built where the school district central office is now. That was a dorm in the borough building and the city offices. That was a dormitory. And then where the payroll office is now, that was a cafeteria. And what they were doing was bringing in not only kids from our villages, but from the Aleutians and up on the Arctic slope and all that area. We were really servicing a large group or a large area.
But those kids were going to a separate high school. It was a separate school.
Well, no, they were coming in, and they were in our high school.
They were living in those facilities.
But they're living in the dorm and eating in the cafeteria and going to school in our high school.
And then going to school in the high school there. Yeah. So they actually were separated from their families all that time.
Yeah, it was a ill-fated concept. Uh-huh. It just simply did not work. I mean, you're talking about kids that are, you know, really insecure to begin with, and then to bring them in this environment.
Without their parents.
Yeah, without their parents, without any securities, without any base at all. It just flopped, you know, big time.
So this
and they have major, major social problems in the dormitories with the kids. It was just a nightmare, any way you turn it.
This was happening between 1970 and...
Yeah, it ran from, you know, I just couldn't be, without looking at an annual,
probably
for a five-year period, or maybe even a little longer than that. And then... I don't even know who was responsible for the regional high school concept. You know, it was implemented big time here in this particular area. They had up in the Nome area what they call the Nome Belt School, and that was another regional attempt at regionalization too. But they were just major flops. I mean, conceptually, the kids just were not successful. They just couldn't deal with it. So, we'd reached a peak of about 750 students, I think, during that era, the largest the high school has ever been.
It stayed and maintained that population.
Yeah.
What kind of subject? I imagine that same kind of subjects were being taught, but is there any kind of subject that is not being taught today, or something that's maybe unique?
stands out?
Well, as I remember, there hasn't been a lot of changes in the area of math, but I can remember back about the time we had that regional high school concept, the English programs and the social studies programs were involved in this. It seems like they use the term phase elective or something like that. They just had a bundle of classes in each of those. You know, social studies, you had things like, in English, you had things like sports literature. I remember a social studies class called Identity. They had, a lot of different just self, you know, courses that are what we would consider very non-traditional.
Okay, so that was happening during the 70s.
Yeah, they called it a phase elective program. Probably there were 20 English classes being offered and maybe 15 different social studies classes being offered.
Was there anything in particular offered due to the increased population of the Native Americans, the Indian population? And was there any...
Can you remember?
Well, the thing we were talking about earlier tonight, that Elwani program.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It seems like that was one of the programs that was made, you know, specifically to involve those students. But when you look at it now, no, they were pretty much expected to survive in a traditional curriculum. I don't think we really made a lot of adjustments for those kids in the curriculum. If you want to be truthful about it. You know, a few things, but like I said, I don't know. I don't think that there was much you could do. There were so many social problems that were created just by the concept that they just came to school totally and completely ill-prepared to deal with anything, no matter if it had been something they're interested in or otherwise.
There was nothing, no classes offered on, let's say, the Native Claims Act or nothing like kayak building or, you know, anything like that.
Well, not classes per se. Now, we had, during that same period of time, we had something called the mini semester, you know, where we took the month of January and offered special types of classes, and some of those things were done in that mini semester.
Hey, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think this started about 1971, if I remember right, and it was an outgrowth because of the situation, because a lot of these kids were Russian Orthodox, as I remember, and they not only were spending the regular traditional Christmas holidays down there, but they were staying through Russian Christmas. So we weren't getting them back here till like late January every year, and they were missing all those classes up to that point. So
they would go home.
Yeah, they'd go home and stay all that time. And I think the mini semester originally was kind of devised to, you know, to say, okay, well, you know, if you're spending all that time at home, we're not going to hold it against you. We'll end the semester before Christmas break, and then you can come back after that, and we'll start the second semester. That was one of the big motivations for it. And then it originally started as to try to promote leisure time activities, you know, to create interest in students for leisure time activities. And there was just a whole host of you know, leisure time things, woodworking, wood carving. I taught cross-country skiing that whole time.
Did you go to take people out?
Yeah, wilderness survival was a major program, really popular one. The skiing program was really popular. And then what they kind of do is divide the day was divided into four segments. And like cross-country skiing was just all day long, so you took it all four segments. And then they'd have some classes were just a half a day each, and then they'd have some that were a quarter of the day each, you know, like some of the physical education activities. And I thought it was really a successful program from the standpoint of you know, teaching and appreciation for life, you know, lifetime leisure activities and dealing with kids on a totally different basis in an academic relationship. It was a lot of fun, just a lot of fun. We really enjoyed it. But it came under a lot of political pressure, and I think we ran it for about 3 years, and then it just couldn't survive the political pressure.
But the whole point of starting it was because
the increased Native American Indian population, and
they're not getting back here.
They're not getting back because of the Russian Orthodox.
If I remember right, that would probably be the number one reason. And then the number two was just exposing kids to, you know, trying to create some interest in lifetime leisure activities and kindling a little bit of interest through that program.
Was there any kind of, just kind of change subject here a little bit, is there any kind of work release program where a student would be able to, let's say, work half day somewhere?
I would say that we have, as I remember, we've always had that in one form or another. You know, at one time I think it was called cooperative ed or something like that. It's taken on, you know, various forms, and now it's kind of where we've transcended now is the EOP program. They farm kids out on job sites and so on. But I would say that we've always had some form of that or another.
Yeah, I think it was called distributive ed.
Distributive ed, yeah, it might be. I don't know where I get the word cooperative ed, but that may be a tag that was on it at one time.
I was just trying to see if there was any kind of community involved, but if there's anything you can remember as far as school, and if you have a community that's involved. I know that some people took field trips and so forth and do things like that. And I was just,
we had a lot of community involvement during the mini semester. I mean, we have those people actually came up and taught the classes, and the existing teaching staff just supported them. You know, I can remember Ken Forrester, who used to run a pizza place here. He came up and taught cooking, and that's just one that I remember. But I can remember several community people teaching classes during the mini semester. I'm talking about something that was 20 years ago now. You know, it's hard to remember all the little intricacies of it, but
yeah.
It was an interesting program. Of course, during that time, education was kind of going through a real liberal state. I mean, we had low graduation requirements. I think we're down to an 18 credit requirement. And of that 18 credits, you had just a very minimal actual required courses. And things were awfully flexible. You know, it's tightened up considerably. I mean, the number of required courses and the number of courses required for graduation has tightened up considerably since that time.
Now, I think I remember reading something about where they actually opened up some of the classrooms, where they would actually, it was the co-concept was tear down the walls of the classroom and integrate between several classes and do those kind of things. Was anything like that going on?
Well, not so much in the high school, but I know when East Elementary School was first built out here, it was built as an open concept classroom school. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have the partitions then. They just had I had a daughter in school out there, and that's, you know, it was just a wide open where they were, and I don't know too much about it, but I know there were several classes would just be in wide open areas, and teachers would be cooperating with one another. And and then I remember one time, we never had this, but I remember going to Ketchikan. I was on accrediting team to re-accredit them for their Northwest accrediting. And they had their English and social studies program. You could either have kids in an open concept, or you could have them in the traditional. They operated both. And the open concept was just a massive room, almost as big as a gymnasium, with just, you know, clustered areas here and there, you know, and all probably six classrooms in the same open area.
This is high school level.
Yeah, this was high school. But Kodiak never had anything anything like that.
Progressive, huh?
No.
That's pretty progressive.
That must have been pretty progressive at the time, yeah. what tickled me is they had one old guy there, he was a teacher, and they didn't want him teaching any classes, so he was a projectionist for the open classroom. All he did was show movies all day long. Had a little corner over here with a probably seating capacity for about 20, and they just send different groups over there, and he'd show them movies all day long.
I don't understand how that could work, but
it was pretty noisy.
Yeah. Let's see what I got. I think I may have just mentioned this to you in the faculty room before, as far as any kinds of, I'm not sure if we want to talk about this, strikes and teacher negotiations, anything that stands up in your mind.
We don't have to talk about that.
Well, if you want to, that this is one area where I've, you know, I spent a lot of my career involved in teacher negotiations. And golly, I don't know how much detail you want in it. I could give you a lot of detail or very little. We've only had one real near strike, and that was back in 1976. In fact, we had we did a last ditch negotiation effort one night. We had the entire association waiting here at St. Mary's School while we were up in the central office trying to negotiate a settlement. And had we not settled that night, there would have been a strike the next day. This was back in 1976. But we managed to convince them of the error of their ways and got a settlement. We're able to come out and tell the people, and we avoided it, thank goodness. Because back in those days, it wasn't legal, or at least the law was unclear about what your status would be concerning the strike. And not that we haven't had negotiations that have been pretty hairy, because we have many years, but we've always managed to get, in the final analysis, get things settled and straightened out, and for the most part, end up with a good contract.
So just one near strike there back in 76.
That was the closest that we ever came.
Closest. So other than that, no real strikes.
A few years ago, about 4 years ago, or maybe longer than that, we were unable to get a settlement through all the different steps that you go through, and we've made some contacts with the Labor Relations Agency about conducting a strike vote. But again, we finally had a meeting with the board and avoided it, even having a strike vote. So it didn't get as far as the one did in 76. And then the last round of negotiations they had here, they were able to settle, you know, pretty easily, actually. Probably one of the easiest settlements we've ever had. So it just depends. It depends a lot on money, and it just depends a lot on willingness.
Change subject here just a little bit. Are there any incidences that happened at the school as far as something that would change the landscape of the school? Was there a fire, or was there a flood, or was there, maybe I'm down searching for some of the dark side here. That'd make a good newspaper reporter, huh?
Golly, I know the only incident that I can remember that of that particular type is, I think it was the second year I taught here. I had my door open and heard this tremendous bang, you know, and I took off running out of the door to see what was going on, and I could tell the general area it was from, and I could see other people heading down here, and I headed down here to where the shop was and ran into the shop, and here's the shop teacher holding this .30-06 that this kid had handed him. In the .30-06, this kid had shown the shop teachers, he'd handed him the .30-06 kind of straight over like this, and shop teacher had kind of grabbed it, and the kid pulled the teacher at the same time, and the bullet went up and hit the top of the shop.
And they were still frozen there.
Dude,
that gunge down in school. I mean.
that was a scary one there. I don't remember any floods, any fires.
No tsunamis, no earthquakes, or anything like that.
Oh, we've had earthquakes and tsunami warnings, but you know, nothing since before I got here in 64.
Any, I think I may have already mentioned some of these to you as far as special visitors. Was there ever a governor that would come here in recent times?
Oh, yeah, I know. It used to be kind of I know, particularly when I was growing up in Cordova. Gosh, I can remember Ernest Gruning, who was
okay.
Yeah, he was a territorial representative. We didn't have senators. They just had territorial representatives. And old Ernest Gruning, he was a great guy. He used to come through Cordova about once a year and promise a swimming pool. And I can remember this from the time I was in grade school. He said, "I'll be back here next year to swim with you in the swimming pool."
Did you ever get a swimming pool?
Never in my day.
We've had
politicians through here. I'm just trying to think who in the world they are.
We can go back to Cordova.
Governor Egan has come to Kodiak and talked here before. Or I think he did. No, maybe not Governor Egan. That would have been too early. I don't remember Hickel coming here. I don't know about Jay Hammond. You know, we haven't had a flood of political personalities that come through here talking to the student body. Celebrities? No.
They don't make it this far anymore.
No, they really don't. Well, you just look, I mean, we had an astronaut last year. That's as close as we got to a celebrity. And the only reason he was here was promoting the launch facility out at Narrow Cape there.
Narrow Cape, Virginia.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to Cordova for a little bit. We'll just kind of go back here. I think I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Cordova. Now, the earthquake, you were in Cordova.
No, I was in Fairbanks going to school during the earthquake.
Oh, so you missed that. Okay, is there anything that you can tell us? Of course, your family was still there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had people down here in Kodiak. We had people in Cordova and people in Anchorage. And there were just a couple days where we didn't hear from them. There was no phone service. You didn't really know what was going on because you saw all the horror stories. You just saw the major area of Anchorage that was destroyed. You saw what was happening in Seward. You heard what was happening in Valdez. And as I remember, it was a couple days before we really heard from anybody. So we were on pins and needles. You know, we felt that we would have heard had there been any problem, but still you just didn't really know. So that was a pretty hairy time. And of course you just wondered about the damage and the lasting damage to those areas. You saw, you know, you didn't have the television service that you have now. You know, there wasn't live TV. If they got anything, it was they made tapes of it and then they flew them up and showed them over TV. So you didn't, you know, the only thing you had was radio, and that was at best was very poor.
So when eventually you got a hold of your folks, your family?
Yeah, eventually they either got a call to us or we got a call to them somehow. I don't remember exactly how, but
so what? How did they fare?
Well, in Cordova, my parents fared fine. I mean, it was kind of a funny thing there because that whole area was uplifted. You know, it was lifted. Just raise the level of it. And my dad had told me that during the time that tidal wave went out there, of course they couldn't see it at night, they just know because boats went dry, the entire bay in Cordova just dried up. There wasn't any water in it at all when that tidal wave sucked it out of there. And then when it came back in, you know, it just came back in slowly, so it didn't create a tsunami when it came back
in. So boats were just laying around them?
Yeah, well, I remember they said that the Coast Guard ship, which was the Sedge then, it had pulled away from the dock and were headed out of town to give assistance to Valdez, I believe. And they went stuck right in the channel. You know, I'm talking about a channel that has 150 foot of water in it.
And they're just sitting out there.
Yeah, just stuck out there. But nobody could take any pictures because it was, you know, it was dark. It was to happen during the nighttime.
And then the water came back before.
And then the water came back before morning. And by the time daylight, it was all stabilized. But there was no real damage in Cordova. You know, nobody lost houses. No docks were washed out. No lives were lost. It was out on the Sound in a little village of Chiniga, I remember, because that village of Chiniga, gosh, for years when I was purse-seining, we used to go in there and anchor up of a night. And that village, probably per capita, they lost more of the people per capita than any other place in Alaska. If I remember right, I think 60 people lost their lives there. The tidal wave came up and they were just trying to crawl to high ground and they couldn't get there. And I know about the only thing left standing in Chiniga Village was the BIA school. And that's only because it was way up high.
Yeah.
And the village houses themselves were right down along the water.
So then when you got to Kodiak, then it was about a year after the quake.
Yeah.
And so you saw a lot of damage here. What was, do you remember maybe, did you feel a different mood or different people, I don't know, were they disaster stricken?
I think they probably pretty much got over that. I think they were optimistic about rebuilding. You know, the place still had a sound economy. And of course, they were getting all that, what do they call it now, urban renewal money. Most of these business owners were able to get urban renewal money and build back. And then they kind of completely just redesigned the downtown area. Prior to that, I'd only been in Kodiak once prior to that, but it was kind of, the downtown area was kind of windy streets, you know, and so there is not a whole lot down there that was there during the earthquake. You know, the Baranoff Museum is in the same place. I think the post office, no, well, you don't know it, it's the Kana building there that's right across the street from where the ferry, that used to be the post office when I first got here, and I think that was originally there during the earthquake.
That's down pretty low.
And that's about it. That, other than that, that entire downtown area has been just totally rebuilt and redesigned. Just about every single building other than that. But see, I wasn't real familiar with Kodiak prior to the earthquake.
Right.
I'd only been over here once, and driven through town, gone out to Whitty Island, and drove back and went to the airport. So I just don't remember that much about it.
Well, you want another
whiskey? Yeah, suds, I guess.
I'm gonna pause this. Okay.
Hadn't been affected by the oil spill where that took place. So I just think it's going to take a long time for Prince William Sound to reach its prior production levels, both in herring and salmon.
Okay, so the oil spill was in 89?
89, yeah.
89, yeah. What month was it?
It was Good Friday, so it was March 27th, about there, wasn't it?
Okay. But you normally fish in there in the spring, right? So you go back there and fish.
Yeah.
So I guess you probably didn't fish that year.
Well, ours was one of the funny areas. I don't know what was going on between Exxon and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. They were bound to determine they were going to have us fish if we possibly could fish. Over here in Kodiak, they just shut it down totally. So over there, if they'd find a place that was free of oil and had some fish in it, they'd open it. And then you might fish for a day and then not fish for a week. And then if people would get oil nets and they'd shut it down, and it was just a joke the way they ran it. We'd been a whole lot better off had we not fished at all.
Okay, so you went over there, so if you got oil in your nets and you stopped, you had to experience that then?
I didn't personally experience that, but I know boats that did. You know, the places we were sailing, we just never got any oil in our nets. I saw oil, you know, but we never got them in the nets. So big splotches of oil.
What? A lot of fish?
Not. There was, but not fish we caught.
Yeah. Was the catch substantially lower, or was it any difference?
Actually, it was a pretty good run that year.
Probably stay away. If you were fishing in the non-oil areas, that's probably where all the fish were.
It was a darn. In fact, it was a darn good run that year. But see, there was no reason why those fish shouldn't have returned, because they, you know, they were out in the ocean during the oil spill, so all they did was come into the sound later on that summer. So that particular run, you know, our ability to catch them was affected by the oil, but the effects on the run was, you know, the fish were already produced and they were already there. So that wasn't, you know, that wasn't any deterministic factor on how oil was going to affect fish. Later years.
Did you, or you or any of your family employed by Exxon for cleanup?
We weren't employed by Exxon directly. We had our boat out on charter, but our boat was chartered to one of the fish hatcheries, and all it did was it just monitored the fish hatchery and kept the boom. They had a boom across the front of the fish hatchery, and our boat just opened it up and closed it and made sure it stayed fastened. So we didn't work for Exxon directly. We worked for the it's called PISWAC, Prince William Sound Aquaculture Association. That's who we worked for probably almost 2 months, I guess.
You yourself manned the boat, or you just...
No, my dad. Okay. My dad did. I was still teaching then. My dad did, and he hired crew and operated it. I never got in on any cleanup at all. I just, when by the time I got over there in late May, I just went gill netting out on Copper River and fished the whole summer.
And with no problems.
Not at Copper River, was far removed from the oil spill, so there was no problems out there. No.
So.
Now, I did go purse seining later on in the season, and that's where we were, you know, we were continually interrupted by oil spill. In fact, I remember one day they were going to have a seine opening, and we'd run out of town. We were probably 5 hours out of town. We were running for the place to where we're going to fish, and all of a sudden they come up on the radio and said, no, we just spotted oil in this area. We're not going to have the opening after all. We just made a 180 and went back to town. And probably sat there for another week. I can't remember how long we sat there, but...
This was during that summer?
Yeah, this was during the summer of 89, yeah.
Okay, subsequent fishing years, did you pull any oil up in your nets or anything?
I don't think they pulled any oil up in the nets, but they were just... I'm just trying to think that the seasons were so poor and the area that you fish was, you know, just so minimal.
So where'd the fish go?
Don't ask me.
So the fish are gone. I mean, you can tell.
Well, yeah, they were just, we just weren't producing the fish that we ordinarily do. And then, but there has been some exceptions because that area is mostly a hatchery reared fishery anymore. It's not a wild stock fishery.